G'day, it's Phil Edwards, Vision CEO here, with a quick invitation to become part of this amazing beacon of hope called Vision. Together we can put our love into action to help people of all kinds build or rebuild their lives on the truth of God. Please consider the part you can play during our upcoming Visionathon appeal, remembering that it's your support that makes Vision possible, including this podcast.
Life, culture, and current events from a biblical perspective. 2020 on Vision.
There's something that excites us as Aussies about travel. We travel for business, we travel for holiday vacations, we travel for education. Sometimes we even travel for pilgrimage. When we can't go and explore the world, we can feel like we're missing out on our God-given freedom to explore. Well, since we can't travel overseas right now, lots of us are likely to be looking for meaningful opportunities to see Australia. So today, an unusual focus as we look into the Christian history of outback New South Wales. And we might be surprised and even a little inspired by the visionaries who shaped Australia with their faith. There are amazing stories of explorers, poets, bushrangers, cameleers, even riverboat captains and ordinary Aussies who shaped Australia. Our guest today is Dr. Paul Rowe. He's an historian and tour guide from Outback New South Wales with 50 years experience in engaging audiences eye to eye, mind to mind and heart to heart with Australia's powerful stories of faith. He has a doctorate in history that focuses on telling our Australian Christian story. And what an absolute privilege it is to welcome to 2020 Dr. Paul Rowe. Paul, welcome.
Thank you, Neil. Pleasure to be here.
Hey, Paul, an outback historian, and lots of people will never have heard that expression before, but how did you get a title of being an outback historian?
Well, Neil, it's a little bit ironic, I suppose, because basically I've got to confess to being a city boy. I was city bred in Sydney, but I've lived most of my life west of the Great Divide, and so I feel like I've got a foot either side of the Great Divide. I did my study and early, you know, university study and so on in Sydney, but most of my life I've lived west of the Blue Mountains, so out at Bourke, about 850 kilometres northwest out in the corner, and then presently in Dubbo. So I suppose it's a little bit unique living in a very small town on the edge of the outback has really shaped me, and it was my apprenticeship, if you like, as a historian out there.
And isn't it amazing that, you know, the gift that we're given, and you've obviously got a tremendous appreciation for all of those wonderful stories that have shaped outback New South Wales, and that's grown into even your own sort of tour business, and you lead tours in the outback of New South Wales. How long have you been doing that for now, Paul?
Well, I should probably explain a little bit wider, Neil, if I can. I went to Bourke in 1978 to begin Cornerstone Community, which was like a Christian kibbutz we had out there. And we had young people coming from all over the world to us out there. So I was 27 years in Bourke. But while I lived in Bourke, one of the things eventually I got involved with, first of all, I was on local council, and then we took on a contract for the tourist centre. And our students, some of our leadership school students, were helping run the tourist business, and we started to help Bourke grow its stories. And so I began experimenting, if you like, with small tours around Bourke, and that sort of evolved into what I'm presently doing. So I've had this dream evolving for quite a long time of leading people into the kind of experiences I had with small pilgrimages, if you like, around Bourke, that led me into understanding, boy, this is dynamic. This is an amazing thing to be doing. So it kind of grew from there.
Well, let's just focus here just for a moment, just a little pause to talk about Cornerstone Community, because Cornerstone Community is still functioning, going strong, and raising up outback leaders. How's all that working these days?
Well, it's shifted a little bit, Neil. We about around 2000 in Bourke, anyway, the big drought came, and so we had to close a couple of centres there. We shifted to other centres like Bendigo and Swan Hill, and now in Orange and so on. And even in that time, the educational structures all changed and the way of delivering education changed. So for one reason and another, we've sort of morphed into more an apprenticeship style of thing that's happening. So the big farms and the sort of outback lifestyle thing has faded somewhat, and we're more slightly more urbanised in country centres. But for a long time, that was our distinctive. We took people into a hard experience, I suppose, of living in the outback and farming and like a kibbutz. And so that was part of the learning experience. And for me as a historian, Neil, I began to see the Bible I was teaching in class and the stories that were I found all around the district. Somehow there was a connection, that it wasn't sort of a big disconnect, but we had a very powerful Christian story that was sort of all over the outback and therefore all over Australia, I think, that had a direct connection to the stories I was teaching in the classroom. So I began to see that if we really wanted to understand ourselves, we had to understand our own story. And the more I researched and thought about it and interviewed a lot of old-timers for the radio station in Bourke, I found I was being educated by them, that they were teaching me the value of my own story. So that's why I say it was my apprenticeship. It took me into this personal relationship with older Australians who lived lives that were anything like I'd lived in Sydney. And it taught me deep respect and appreciation for what these people had given to us. And sometimes they're good stories, sometimes they're pretty sad stories. Like with the Aboriginal people, there were stories, chapters that were very hard to listen to. But it sort of took me into the grassroots of our history. And as I was teaching the Bible at the same time, I began to realise, you know, there's a lot of similarities here, that a lot of the Bible was sort of lived out in the outback, if you like, in rough country and oftentimes in deserts. And Jesus himself lived sort of up country, and he was a country storyteller. So I began to find there was a commonality and a resonance there with what I was teaching in the classroom and the people I was moving out amongst in the outback then.
Well, you know, mostly when we think of talking about Australia's Christian history, we get bogged down. Let me not say that in a bad sense, but usually we're talking about Sydney. We're talking about the earliest days. And really, I think in Australian terms, we tend not to have a big understanding of our Christian history. And so we're always retelling the stories of, the arrival of the First Fleet. We're talking about Richard Johnson, Samuel Marsden. We're focusing on things that happened in Sydney. And those are very colourful stories too. But Christianity really overflowed Sydney and moved especially into outback New South Wales in a magnificent and amazing way. As you say, yes, there's going to be some sad stories in there as well, but the overflow into the outback, it was a Christian revolution, wasn't it, in that sense of missionaries and people who are carrying their faith into the outback?
Well, I think I have a little saying that Jesus' footprints and fingerprints are all over our country. And I think what I found remarkable, Neil, was living in this small country town, 3,000 people, in a very big shire that was the size of Denmark, with about 2 million kangaroos and about 1 million emus. Yeah. It was amazing as I was listening and following the stories of Bourke to find, even though it was a small town and remote town, but the stories that had happened there had grown into something amazing, as big as Australia. So I came across characters there that were astonishing, really. So in the 1890s, for example, in Bourke, Bourke began about 1860, and the first riverboat got to Bourke. So Bourke very quickly developed into Australia's most inland port, and massive amounts of wool by 1890 were being transported away down the river. There was something like 15 million sheep in the back corner of New South Wales within 30 years. And the biggest sheep station in the world was there. It was a combination of three stations, Terrell, Knockaleechee and Dunlop, and it was owned by a man called Samuel McCackie, who'd arrived in backcountry Victoria as a young man without anything. And he, through his uncles, he got a start, and he proved to be a man of tremendous capacity. He was basically the father of the Murrumbidgee Irrigation Scheme. And then he owned these three big properties in Bourke by the mid-1880s, and he was the first man to use mechanical shears in Australia. He was the first, he was an inventor of many, many sort of earth-moving equipment, if you like. He was a prodigious builder. He built homesteads, and by the mid-1880s, he was shearing a quarter of a million sheep on his own property. And so he had this enormous capacity, and he was a man of education. He had an encyclopedic knowledge of English literature, and he was a Christian. He was a Presbyterian man, and he had a very big heart for people. And so he was a philanthropist. So in the 1890s, he formed the Pastoralist Union in Bourke to fight the Shearers Union, which was forming in Bourke at the same time. The Australian Shearers Union was forming around the 1890 mark, and a bloke called William Spence had come up from Victoria, and he also was a Presbyterian preacher, and his stated aim was to show the working men that Jesus Christ cared for them. And so the Shearers Union eventually became the AWU, the Australian Workers Union, which eventually morphed into the Labor Party. So he was a man of great Christian conviction. He wanted to help the men. And so in the 1890s, he was in the streets of Bourke with all the Labor leaders who were living there at the time. They were all the cutting-edge socialists, if you like, of the time. And when Henry Lawson came to Bourke in 1892, he began to write for them. And a lot of the stories he wrote into the Bulletin in Australia were stories from Bourke and stories of the union men that he met. And he was a sort of a convinced unionist because he identified with the men. He walked from station to station looking for work himself, so he knew how hard it was. So you had these two men leading the two opposing unions who were both Christians, both Presbyterians. Eventually, Samuel Mukaki, when he died in 1919, he sold everything he had and put it into trust for churches, education and hospitals. And it was about £38 million in those days. So he's basically the Bill Gates of Australia.
Wow.
And it's still, you know, Bourke Hospital still gets money from the Mukaki Fund. There are chairs in universities that are still funded by the Mukaki Fund.
That is amazing. And I think listeners will be amazed when you start to say that the union leaders of the day were Presbyterian preachers. And so those sorts of foundations.
Well, some of them were.
We often will sometimes reflect on Christian foundations of the labour movement, and of course that looks a little bit different today. And I'm not taking you into a political conversation, except to say you've discovered that there is so much Christian history that even shapes the way the labour movement formed in Australia, because it was all about Christian leaders there wanting the welfare of workers. Is that a fair enough way of assessing that?
Well, I think that's true. I mean, if you trace the origins of the labour movement back through, a lot of it has to do with Methodists in England. And then I think a lot of what the unions had was driven by the Methodists. And they understood small group action. And so I think the idea of cadres in the socialist or the union movement came out of the Methodist movement. Personally, I think there's a very strong link there. And a lot of the leaders in England were Christian men and women. And so I think it's fair to say, I wouldn't say the whole movement was Christian. That's probably going too far. But it was certainly underpinned by very strong Christian values.
And let's talk about the idea that if you were jumping in the car and loading the family up right now, and the realism here is that there's still some border issues around different states around the place, but if you're mum and dad and throwing the kids into the car because it's holiday time and you're thinking, well, we've done the beach, we've done the mountains, how about we go and explore some Christian history in outback New South Wales? Is there a way that you can do that? I mean, yes, you're leading tours, but can you put the family in the car and all of a sudden go on a pilgrimage to find our Christian history? Can people do that?
Well, that's a pretty good question, Neil, and I think that's really what's driven me somewhat after all my experience and things, so that's why I'm doing this first pilgrimage, really. because I feel, no, you can't. Like, you can explore some of it. And in Bourke, for example, I was involved in, 20 years ago, getting together our history in Bourke and the Bourke region. And so there's a beautiful interpretive centre in Bourke called the Back of Bourke Exhibition Centre. And and I had a fair bit to do with writing the stories there. And so, I tried to keep a balance, and I tried to write the honest Christian story in there. So, you know, if you came to that centre, you would find stories of, for example, the Far West Children's Scheme was begun in the 1920s by the Reverend Stanley Drummond and his wife from Cobar. And they were men and women of great heart. And I interviewed old-timers who knew them and very much appreciated what they gave to the backcountry. And people like Nancy Bird, the aviatrix, she actually flew, as a 19-year-old girl, she flew for Far West Children's Scheme, inspired by Reverend Stanley Drummond. And also she flew for the Flying Doctors with John Flynn. And she told me, when I interviewed her some years ago, that she said, well, Mr. Flynn and Mr. Drummond were like fathers to me as a young girl pilot in the outback. So they were covering vast areas of the outback with Christian compassion in a practical, sleeves-rolled-up sort of fashion. And the sad thing, I think, Neil, is that Australia's forgotten that they're very ready to accept and appreciate the work of the Flying Doctor Service and of the Far West Children's Scheme. But the thing that drove their founders is often buried. It's lost. It's become invisible. That John Flynn was a man of faith. And I've taken a pilgrimage of young boys, 15-year-old boys from Wyoming, New South Wales, up to Darwin. And twice I've led them through the John Flynn story and stood them in front of John Flynn's grave in Alice Springs and said to them, you know, you boys, you know, John Flynn was 16 when God put a call on his heart. What do you want God to do with your lives? And I saw those boys square their shoulders and look at me and say, I'd really like God to use me for something. And so I think there are heroes like these men that we need to be introducing, not just because they're religious, but because they're men and women of caliber. It was their faith that gave them their backbone. It was the sinews of their faith that drove what they did. And I think it's sad that we've lost that. And my passion is to reintroduce, to surface that invisible story as it's become. In fact, I'll even go so far as to say there's been a fairly cynical attempt by secular historians and others to edit the Christian story out of our story. And my passion is to reinstate it, to bring it back into focus, not because just because it's religious or because it agrees with my faith, but because it is part, it's an integral part of our Australian story. So in answer to your question, no, you will not always find the story. It's sort of lost. And the job, I feel, is that we've got to recover that story. And I want to inspire young men and women, historians, teachers, preachers, chaplains, to get a hold of our local stories and tell them, because we need to know our own story.
Well, Paul, all I can say is there's a great weight of responsibility sitting on your shoulders now to make sure that this wonderful knowledge that you have gained in all of your studies and this 50 years of being an outback historian, we're going to be waiting for some wonderful publications and ways that we can explore these things. And as you say, the best way to appreciate those things is to actually go to these places. And when you've got an expert tour guide, as you no doubt, well, as listeners can hear, the way you'll be able to relay those sorts of stories would be absolutely priceless. Wonderful.
Life, culture, and current events from a biblical perspective. 2020 on Vision.
Hey, we're talking about the Outback Christian history and focusing in on Outback New South Wales. But if you're in other states and territories around Australia, feel free to call in and let us know what some of the Christian history is. And you'll need to keep it nice and brief, but keep those history issues coming. 1-800-316-316. Dr. Paul Rowe is our guest. Hey, Paul, you're leading a tour between Dubbo in New South Wales and Bourke. And you've got it's a 7-day tour, and it sounds to me to be action-packed. Give us an, in a nutshell, way that you can actually talk about Australia's outback Christian history in a tour between Dubbo and Bourke.
Okay, well, In Dubbo, I worked with an Indigenous brother here, and we discovered, worked together on bringing a very, very important story to light. And we discovered that there was a lost story about a man called Bill Ferguson, who was an Indigenous man who lived in Dubbo in the 1930s. And we agreed that this man was, in fact, the Martin Luther King of Australia, because in 1937, one of the first civil rights movements in Australia to stand up for the rights of the Indigenous people. He was a Christian man. He was an elder in the Presbyterian Church, which was rare in those days to have an Indigenous man as a leader in a church. And he, with another brother and an Indigenous man in Victoria, a man called Bill Cooper, together they led the first civil rights action on Australia Day in 1938, and they went to Parliament and they asked the Prime Minister, from the Bible, they were both Christian men, the Bible says we're all God's children, why aren't we being treated as such? Well, we managed to get Bill Ferguson's story up in front of children. We tell it in the schools, and part of what happened about a year ago was that the city agreed to put a statue of Bill Ferguson right in the centre of the city. So he's now a main feature of this town. So that's a beginning point to tell the story of a Christian man who stood up for the rights of the Indigenous people, and it belongs to Dubbo. So that's a beginning point, and so we'll introduce people to that and a couple of other stories of, another Indigenous man who's taken action, Peter Gibbs, who's begun the iProud movement to help train Indigenous police, and another Tongan man who's leading what's called Tradies Inside here in Dubbo to help tradies who are in strife with depression and suicide. So I want them to meet men and women who are proactive in helping their fellow men, and that there's some great stories here in Dubbo. So that's where we begin. We go through Narromine, which has got an aero history, and there's a beautiful aero museum there. And then we head to Bourke through, well, Banjo Patterson territory, some of the stories he wrote about Clancy of the Overflow, and then into Bourke, and pick up a lot of the Bourke stories. Some of them I've told you, but there are many, many others. And that was the thing, Neil, that I found, even though they were small towns, these stories were big stories, you know. And so then we follow, we swing away from Bourke down through to a little town on the Darling called Louth. And so we go through Terrell Station, which was owned by McCackie. We hear his story. We go to Gundabooka National Park, where an Indigenous man, a Christian brother, is a ranger there, and he tells the story of his own people there. Then we swing it back through Brewarrina, through the famous fish traps there, which are probably the oldest man-made construction in the world. And again, we meet some Indigenous people there, and then head south into the Macquarie Marshes, which would be beautiful. Actually, if you're travelling out west this time, it's beautiful. It's a fantastic spring at the moment, and after the rain. And then we head across to Coonabarabran, and we catch up with the Warrumbungle, the story of the Warrumbungle Mountains and Siding Springs Observatory. So there's the whole story of the stars, and then back through Gilgandra to Dubbo. So it's an eight-day sort of circuit we do.
You actually go past Cuddy Springs, and a place renowned to be the only place in Australia where there's fossil evidence of humans and megafauna, such as diprotodons coexisting. How do you tell the story of, this sort of ancient history here?
Well, that's a good question. You've caught me out a little bit there. I'm not an expert. I just know that is a fact. But it is quite astonishing that we've got this ancient history, and the footprints of the Indigenous people alongside some pretty serious big animals back there. How you interpret that is another question, but it'll be an interesting one. I'm sure it'll cause a lot of discussion.
I just mentioned that because just last week I had a conversation and we were talking about dinosaur footprints and the idea that human and dinosaur footprints might be in the same section. That throws all sorts of challenging issues for people who believe a solid evolutionary theory, when in fact a biblical sense here is that in a biblical sense we have humans and dinosaurs existing together. But we're not going into that whole depth of that today. We're talking about going on a tour, and so going on a holiday. The sort of people that you lead on your tours, are they people who are on holidays, or do they have a special idea, or they're doing some special academic study, or school groups? I mean, or will you take anybody, Paul? Who's the sort of people that actually come on a tour with you?
Okay, well, if I can go back, Neil, when I was in Bourke, with the group of school kids I was teaching, because we had such a strong literary history in Bourke, so we had Breaker Morant, a famous sort of soldier poet who died in the Boer War. He lived in Bourke, along with another Scots poet called Will Ogilvie, and then Lawson, Henry Lawson. They were all in Bourke about the same time. Shortly after that, around the 1900 mark, a very famous Australian writer, Charles Bean, came to Bourke, wrote two books about Bourke, went to Gallipoli and France as Australia's war historian, came back with that story and planted it in the War Memorial in Canberra. So he wrote 5 million words about the Anzacs and basically gave us the Anzac story. But he said the men he met in the trenches were the men he met in Bourke and admired their great tenacity and skill. So we had a very rich literary history here in Bourke. So I took these kids on a trek and I said, okay, we'll go to where they actually wrote these poems. We'll visit the places. So we went on this outback trek. And after that had been such a success, when we got took over the tourist centre, I found myself saying, well, I think we could turn this into a tourist pilgrimage. So we did. It became a very successful thing called the Poet's Trek. And so we'd take people every year and follow the steps of Henry Lawson and Breaker Morant, and we'd tell their stories on location. And something I discovered, Neil, was that when you take people to the place it happened and you tell the story there, some real magic happens.
Paul, as we continue our conversation on from here, some important elements. You have a passion for training up storytellers. It's all very well to say, hey, Paul's a great storyteller and he's leading these tours, but you want to see this spread far and wide, don't you?
Well, that's true, Neil. I think, in fact, we're all storytellers. Every day we're telling stories. And we need to sort of, if we get a hold of the stories that have shaped us, shaped Australia, then we'll be richer for it, I think.
And, of course, you want to be able to get into some resources that are easily accessible to people who might be listening to our conversation now. And so you've got the launch of a new website that's coming up at the end of October. Yep. What's all that about?
Well, I realise at this end of my life, I mean, I've had all the experiences, and as you say, I've learned a lot about storytelling and particularly the eye-to-eye, mind-to-mind, heart-to-heart, which I borrowed from the Scottish Storytelling Centre, to be honest. But they said we need to rescue people from the solitary confinement of the screen, and that for eons, like gathering the tribe around the campfire and telling them the stories of their people has been a powerful way of shaping a culture. So Moses told the people back in the desert, you need to tell these stories to your children, every generation. If you stop telling the kids the stories, if you stop living the story, then it'll die. And if you follow the history of Israel, you'll see when they stopped telling their stories, that's when they lost the plot. But by the same token, the story of Israel, and you think of their long, long history, the one thing that's kept them together through an extraordinary history of persecution and being deported and driven out is their story. That's the one thing they had. They had their story, and they kept that story alive by telling it in their synagogues or to their children around the meal table. And I think there's something we've got to learn, Neil, that we need to be telling our children the stories and living the stories ourselves. So the Aboriginal people, of course, had done this for a long, long time, and they had what they called song lines. As they walked their country, they'd sing their song line, and their song line told them who they were, where they'd come from. Every mountain, every tree, every river, every rock had some story associated with it, and that would make them feel grounded in their own territory. That would show them who they were. And they had a little saying, if you don't know your songline, you don't exist. By singing your songline, you keep the story alive, which is pretty powerful, isn't it?
It is so, so powerful. And it's interesting, when we talk about the way that our modern academics try to write out the Christian connection, a little bit of an illustration in there, isn't there? Because lots of listeners will be familiar with the Royal Flying Doctor's Service and will say, oh, isn't that a wonderful organisation, and it's got a rich Australian history, and founded by John Flynn. And what often is left off that is that it's the Reverend John Flynn who founded the Royal Flying Doctor's Service. There's even a visitor experience in Dubbo that's part of your tour. When we reflect on how these things can be easily lost, yes, there are going to be some stories there, but the Christian connection is the thing that some people are trying to write out of our history. What are your thoughts around the way that happens?
Yeah, well, that's a good question, Neil. I think... Well, as I said, I led a tour with young blokes, and John Flynn is, in fact, the most memorialised Australian. I think he's got more statues and interpretive centres than anybody else. And if you go from Dubbo to Darwin, you'll find them all along the way. But in visiting those centres, I would say that, and as I say sort of carefully, I'm not sort of being overly critical, but I was sad to find that very, very few, they might call him the Reverend, but they don't really tell that part of his story, which was deeply rooted in faith. And the men and women who went with him, most of them also went into those nurses who went way into the outback, or the pilots who flew, or the doctors that went there, were men and women of faith. That's why they went there. And I said to these boys, look, John Flynn, at 21, he wrote to his dad, "Dad, if Jesus Christ is God's son, and he really entered this world to show us the Father, then why aren't we doing more to show people this?" And so for him, the Flying Doctor Service was an expression of the kingdom of God. He said, people out here don't need churches so much as they need hospitals. They need connection, they need community. And so he gave his whole life to connecting the people of the bush to medical care, and through the pedal radio that Alfred Traeger invented, a young nerd from down in South Australia, together they gave the bush a voice. And with the voice came education for children on School of the Air and so on. And so his mantle of safety was more than just medical care. But as a padre said to me down in Broken Hill, well, John Flynn put two mantles of safety over Australia. He also put a spiritual mantle of safety, because he had padres who travelled and visited the stations and gave pastoral care to the people. So it's good that I think what's happened is the second mantle of safety, that spiritual mantle, has been forgotten. And our secular historians have decided, well, we're not allowed to talk about, name the name of Jesus anywhere, because we don't want to offend people. But it makes me cranky. It gets me angry thinking, well, it's not like we're talking religion. We're talking about the motivation of these people. Why did they actually do it? And why can't we say that? You know, it just drives me crazy to think that part of the story's gone missing. And wow. So we need to get storytellers who will step into the gap there. And I think we need interpreters of the story, because I know that the stories are all there. I come across them in every town and village and city I go to. I can see stories everywhere, but people walk past it and don't see it. So, for example, when I went to the big war memorial in Melbourne, some friends took me in there, and we'd been talking about the Anzac story and so on. And we went into the big atrium there, and they stand you in the middle of this big marble floor under a big roof, and they stand you around this rock in the middle of the floor, and they say, you know, on the 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month, the sun shines through that hole in the roof right onto this rock here. And there's words carved on the rock. And so the lady stood us there and she said the Lest We Forget poem. And then I said to her, so what's the rock? What's with these words on the rock? Because carved into the rock is the other words, greater love has no man than this. Then he laid down his life for his friends. And she looked at me and she said, well, it's from the Bible, but it's not religious. I said, oh, really? And I said, that's interesting. So do you know who said it? And she didn't. So she found somebody else and he came back. I said, oh, I think it's Jesus. Anyway, he made up a story. Now, I'm not denigrating those people, but I think it comes back to us, Neil, to say, well, hang on a minute. Why aren't we there saying to people, well, actually, why did the City Fathers choose those words in 1919 to express the great loss of young life. Why did they choose those words? Why didn't they choose Aristotle or Plato or Henry Lawson or whatever? But they chose the words of Jesus because he not only said it, but he actually did it. He laid down his life for his friends and his enemies. Well, that's a big story, and it has shaped our whole culture here. You know, it's demonstrable. There's more evidence than you can poke a stick at that says the footprints of Jesus are all over this country. And I think it's time we Christians stood up and told the stories, because if we don't tell it, nobody else is going to.
That is just fascinating and so, so powerful. And when you say, in the wake of the likes of the Reverend John Flynn came a spiritual mantle of safety for outback communities, and I know there'll be a lot of people in outback communities listening right now to our conversation saying, wow, I wish that spiritual mantle was still really powerful in my town. And so when these stories get revived, those sorts of spiritual mantles can be restored. Hey, there's plenty of stories, and we haven't got a lot of time to touch on all of the ones that we could talk about today, but there's another one from the Bush brothers. Touch on the Bush brothers for us.
Well, around 1900, there was a young man who was a top athlete, and he was serving the British government here in Australia, but he was out shooting in Macquarie Marshes above Dubbo here. And he came across a little girl out living on the station who knew nothing about Jesus. And he was appalled. He was shocked, you know, and he said, I'm going to do something about this. So when he went back to England, his name was Freddie Campion, he went to his bishop and Bishop Temple and said, you know, we need to do something. So they decided they would get young men from England, from Oxford University mainly, to come to Australia on mission and give 5 years of their life to serving in the bush, which they did. And they had a base here in Dubbo and one up in Rockhampton, I think, and Longreach. And they began, these men came from all the way from England, and they'd spread out into the bush. So some went to Bourke, Gilgandra, out further out past Cobar and so on. And these young men in the 1920s were travelling the bush in pretty beat-up old cars. And they were partly from the high church tradition, but I think the bush taught them a lot about themselves. And I've talked to people in the bush who still appreciate and look back to the days when the Bush brothers would visit and run a Sunday school, or they'd run communion or whatever for the people on the stations, and or just hang out like John Flynn taught his padres, just hang out with them, do what they could on the station, maybe help out with some station work, and serve the people of the outback. So the Bush brothers, there was one particular young bloke, he was the first Australian Bush brother, John Martin. He went to Bourke at 22, and he was serving an area as big as England. And he was driving his old team model forward, and he was getting bogged and breakdowns and goodness knows what. But he just thrived on it. And the people of Bourke really, really appreciated his service. He would play piano for their dancers. He'd go and spend a night in the hospital helping the nurses. Whatever was to be done, he was there. He gave himself utterly to the people of the bush. Well, we should be proud of young men like that, and their stories should be told. I mean, he died at 29 in Sydney playing soccer with some street kids down there in the Domain. But, you know, Neil, I just feel we've got these men and women of faith who are real heroes, and we need to give kids real heroes, and these stories need to be told. Now, a thing that shocked me, I think, and here I'm not being discriminatory, but I think it really stabbed me awake when I found that the state government of Victoria and the federal government had funded a museum for Muslim history in Melbourne, which has been open for a few years, and they're getting 30, 40, 50,000 people in schools coming through there to learn the Muslim history of Australia. Well, that's okay. I mean, that's fair enough. There is a history of those people here. And I was shocked when I looked on the website and they had a group of young blokes travelling Australia looking for Afghan history. And they found their big find was in Bourke, was a little tin shed which we've got in the cemetery there, which was probably the first mosque in Australia. And I rescued it. When I was the historian up there, the old lady who owned it, it was in her backyard, told me, well, she'd been sold to an Afghan cameleer in the early 1900s as for 10 shillings as a bride, a 13-year-old. And she lived with I lived with that man for 56 years. Well, it's an amazing story. But when I saw those fellows, they were down praying in front of their mosque, At first I was thinking, oh, what did I do? And then I realised, well, actually, no, that was part of the history of Bourke. But I know the history of Bourke very well, and I know that the Christians have given 1,000 times more than those Afghan Camelis who came basically to drive camels. But I know that Mother Teresa, for example, had nuns in Bourke. I know that Mother Mary MacKillop had nuns in Bourke who served in education and served the people of Bourke. I know the Bush brothers were there. I know there are clergymen of all kinds. Cornerstone had been there. Flying Doctor Service, Far West Children's Scheme, you name it. There's been a prodigious input by Christians into that town. And the shame was, and this is what stabbed me awake, Neil, was that who's telling our story? Because we're not. You know, the Muslims have got active and they've got up and they've got a museum and they're telling their story. Well, you've got to applaud them and say, well, good for them. But it's shame on us that we haven't got our stories together, because I think everywhere across Australia those footprints are there and they're not being told. And so the shame, the responsibility lies with us, because we're the custodians of the story. And like Moses said, you need to be telling your story to your children. And I think we failed to do what Jesus said we should do, put our light up on a hill, let men see your good works, and glorify the Father in heaven.
Well, I'm going to ask you if there's some way that listeners can know what the address is for this new website that you're talking about for the 28th of October with that launch. I'll ask you about that in just a few moments, and listeners might like to grab a pen or a pencil to write that down. But what we're talking about here is, as you say, there is effort being made to outline and highlight Muslim history, even, as you say, Afghan history in Australia. But where is the Christian history being housed? Now, you have a goal somewhere down the track, and no doubt it's a big process. No doubt it's an expensive process too, but maybe it doesn't need to be as expensive as what the ultimate goal might be to get things underway. But you've got a goal to create a storytelling apparatus in Canberra. No doubt it's going to cost dollars, and there needs to be some more visionaries that join you along the journey. But that's a huge goal. What have you got in mind with the possibility of that happening?
Well, I think when I began in Bourke, we began saying we need to tell our Bourke story. So we had 12 volumes of Bourke history. I was thinking, how do we get this out there? And so we set ourselves to work, and over a 10-year period, we raised $8 million, and we built a top-class facility in Bourke called the Back of Bourke Exhibition Centre. Now, people at the time in Bourke were saying, oh, you'll never get it done. Why would they build that in a small town like this, et cetera, et cetera? But it's there. And that taught me a lesson, Neil, that if you believe something should be done, then you can get it done. And out of that experience, I began to see with a friend who was an expert in museums. He was a design manager in the Powerhouse Museum in Sydney, a Christian. We began to share a dream that, you know, why couldn't we tell our Christian story at a top level in a world-class facility in our own national capital, because it's missing. There's a missing story there in Canberra that's not being told. And, you know, when 100,000 kids go to the War Memorial every year and see the Anzac story, and it's a big story, but it's a narrow story. It's about war, it's about men. It mostly happened outside Australia. I think we Christians have a wider, deeper, longer, more powerful history to tell, and we're not telling it. And so we began to dream a dream with a group of others. Professor Stuart Piggin has written two magnificent books on Australia's evangelical history recently. So we're not short of resources in that sense. The research has been done. Then Meredith Lake wrote her book on the Bible in Australia and so on. So there's some excellent books been published. But who's going to sit down and read, you know, 1,000 pages of Australia's Christian history? Not many people, but they will go to a museum. Museums have become one of the sources of authority. In fact, people look to museums more than they do to the church or to even schools for their information. So it's time we engaged people with these great stories, and we've got fantastic stories to tell. And I should say, Neil, too, we need to tell not just the good stories, not just hagiography, not making saints, but we need to tell honestly the bad stories or the ugly stories as well, and then the redeemed stories. And so it's the good, the bad, and the redeemed. And I think if we give that as a gift to Australia and make them accessible, so this could cost $100 million. If we're going to do it well, We need to build the very best facility because we've got the very best stories. And it's a very, very significant part of Australia's history. And so we owe it to our own country to remind Australians, whether they're secular or atheist or Hindu or Buddhist or whatever, that this is where so much of what we have, the blessing we have in this COVID time, for example, the medical care, the social welfare, all that, where did it come from? It didn't just drop out of the sky. It actually was invested by hundreds and thousands of fine men and women of faith who gifted this country with the structures that we have that we take for granted. And it's time we stood up and said, and don't forget that the source of their initiative came from their faith.
Wow, and the urgency of what you're saying now can't be underestimated. As you say, this is a history that needs to be on display, because as you say, there's some fabulous resources that really only just recently have become so available. The work of Professor Stuart Piggin, you mentioned Meredith Lake, another historian, Mike Spencer, who wrote One People, One Destiny. I mean, there are some really recently.
John Harris wrote
One Blood.
And
so we've got some of this. It is fairly recent, but it needs to have depth. And as you say, people won't read a big academic volume on history, but they'll go to a museum. They'll go to an exhibition centre. And all honour to you for the Back of Burke Exhibition Centre. And that's a part of your tour as well. But the idea of getting some sort of apparatus in place in the national capital in Canberra, that's got urgency to it. And so the encouragement to listeners today is to capture a hold of that sort of vision. And some listeners may want to be on the team to help make that happen.
Absolutely.
It's a challenging time to make it happen. But as I say, the urgency can't be underestimated. Hey, we have run out of time. And I did mention you've got your website release coming up on the 28th of October. Is there a website address that listeners can get a hold of? What is it?
Yes, so on the 28th we'll have the Outback Historian, one word, .com.au. Simple as that.
The Outback Historian.com.au. So for listeners to write that down, the Outback Historian.com. I'm writing it down now, as we say, .au. And, of course, for people who want to be a part of one of your amazing tours, I did mention you've got one coming up, the next pilgrimage from Dubbo to Burke, 25th of October to the 1st of November, assuming everything's going to be good there so far as coronavirus. People book that through olivetreetravel.com.au. That's olivetreetravel.com.au. And just honour to you. It's just been a wonderful conversation. And, Paul, let's plan to do this again sometime soon. We'll pick up on some more of those wonderful stories and maybe monitor along the way any moves towards the possibility of a museum in Canberra, which it's a wonderful vision. Dr. Paul Rowe, historian, tour guide, do take advantage. Jot down that, go to that website when it's launched, the outbackhistorian.com.au, Olive Tree Travel, to join one of Paul's tours. Paul, thanks so much for your update today and for sharing your thoughts and your heart with us on 2020.
Well, Neil, thank you for the opportunity.
Thanks for taking time to listen to this audio on demand from Vision Christian Media. To find out more about us, go to vision.org.au.